in free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Friday, August 8th, 2014. What a time I had last night at the Yes concert. It's still not the same without John Anderson, of course. But John Davison does a creditable job, that's for sure. And we had a great time. My wife and I took our 11-year-old. So one of our children came with us, Regina. And if you're on my Facebook page, you saw pictures. Or if you're one of the 20% of my Facebook followers that Facebook allowed to see that picture. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, because it was pictures of, you know, us at the concert, and then there was a picture of Regina and me wearing the concert shirts that we bought, and it was fun. But on Facebook now, for pages like mine, Facebook.com/Thomas E. Woods is a page. It's not a regular Facebook account. It's so that this way you can have more than 5,000 people on your page. Well, I've got about 60,000. And the problem is that very few people are allowed to see my posts in their news feed. And this is because Facebook tries to decide what they think you're going to be interested in. And I'm inclined to think people who went to the trouble to like my page are going to be interested in my posts. But these days it's gotten terrible. If I get 25% of my followers on Facebook being able to see one of my posts, it's a miracle. So I spend money promoting my posts to get them out there to the audience. So if you're following that, well, stop in from time to time and have a look. Defy the Facebook algorithm and just look at it manually. Or you can be always notified of everything I post on Facebook. Just go to the page, facebook.com/Thomas E. Woods, not Tom Woods, facebook.com/Thomas E. Woods. And then where it says liked on the page, there's a little check mark that says liked. That shows that you've liked the page. Hover your cursor over there, and you'll get a little menu, and you'll have an option to click Get Notifications. Click Get Notifications, and you'll know every single time I post something. So anyway, we had a great time at the show. Next week on this show, we're going to get Ron Paul back. So you're definitely going to want to tune in. We're going to get somebody to talk about these airstrikes that the president has authorized in Iraq. And as a matter of fact, speaking of Facebook, just today I posted the following. Let's see if I can get my Facebook account up. Here we go. I posted this. Every so-called conservative who was tricked by government propaganda in 2003, repeat after me, quote, I was grotesquely wrong to have thought nothing could be worse than Saddam Hussein. I admit that Ron Paul predicted what we are seeing now while I was standing with Hillary Clinton in support of the stupidest war in U.S. history. Next time, I will be more skeptical of government propaganda, which, as a conservative, I am supposed to be in the first place. All right, well, I've lost, I guess, at least 10 people from my page because of saying this. I mean, that anybody who was following my Facebook page still believed any of the Iraq War propaganda is amazing to me. And apparently being on the page wasn't doing them any good to begin with, so I guess it's just as well that they're not following it anymore. It's a shame, because maybe being exposed to what I was linking to might have helped. But anyway, help me fill that gap. Go to TomWoods.com or TomWoodsRadio.com and click like on the Facebook widget, and then visit me over there from time to time, and you will really, really, really make me happy. This is really where we have conversations about the show. I post a lot of the episodes on Facebook, and then in the comment threads there, we talk about the show, and I'd love to get your feedback. This is also where you can suggest guests, is the Facebook page. Facebook, Facebook, Facebook. Even though they drive me crazy, maybe the more of you who are on there, the more of you who click like on the posts, the more of you who share the posts, then the greater the reach of my posts on the newsfeed. It's that when they think people like the stuff, then they spread it out into the newsfeed. Okay, today we are welcoming back Jeff Taylor. We had Jeff on to talk about his book Politics on a Human Scale some time ago, and I said we'd need to have him back on to talk about his experiences as a Ron Paul delegate at the Republican National Convention in 2012, and today is that day. Jeff Taylor is a professor of political science at Dort College in Iowa, and he joins us today to tell us what really went on. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks, Tom. Great to be with you again.
Since you were a Ron Paul delegate and I wasn't, I'm going to throw a lot of this program over to you to tell us about things you observed and what your impressions were, etc. Before we do that, though, tell us, how does somebody get chosen to be a delegate at the convention for Ron Paul?
Well, it's not easy for a couple different reasons. For one thing, there's a lot of competition when you want to go to the national convention. There's not very many spots for each state, and so it isn't easy to get there just for that basic reason. The state of Iowa that I represented, there were 28 voting delegates for our state. And then all told, if we count the alternates who also go, who participate but don't actually cast a vote for president on the convention floor, there were about 52 of us total. So it's kind of a selective group, first of all. And then secondly, if you're supporting a candidate like Ron Paul, who, as you and your listeners understand, was an insurgent anti-establishment candidate, you're also then facing a lot of opposition within the party hierarchy in order to get there. So in my case in Iowa, I had an opportunity in May of 2012 to be added to the Ron Paul slate for my state. Now, Iowa is a caucus state, as we know. It's the very first state that votes during the primary season, and it's a multi-step process where we start off with local caucuses in January, and then by the time you get to the summer, you work your way up to the state convention. And it was at the state convention that I was elected, and I was really elected because I had contacted the Ron Paul chair in our state, Drew Ivers, and I expressed interest in being added to the slate because I assumed we were going to be working as a team and trying to get elected, and that's what happened. And he was kind enough to add me first as an alternate, and then eventually I got bumped up to a voting delegate.
All right, now that we've gotten the preliminaries out of the way, I want to get your anecdotes, your observations. I want to get the texture of the convention, what it was like being there. Of course, but before I let you do that, I want to know, how did you feel being there? And what I mean by that is, you're surrounded by people who are there committed to vote for Romney. Surrounded by them. What does that make you feel? And they don't think of you guys generally as being the loyal opposition, you know, who are maybe wrong on one or two things, but basically they're part of the same group. They think of you guys as the enemy.
Yes. Well, yes, that's problematic, just, you know, on a personal level, if nothing else, because, you know, you feel like, well, are you the skunk at the party or you know, one of a minority of skunks at a party, and you're not really wanted in a lot of ways. And, that's part of the problem with the national conventions in the modern era is that they really are less conventions than coronations. So the presidential nominee, everybody knows who it's going to be months ahead of time. We haven't had a competitive convention where we really was in doubt as to who was going to be nominated in the Republican Party since 1976, when Reagan and Ford were still dueling it out, and it was a neck-and-neck race right through the convention. And so with a coronation, if you're not enthused about the new king, that is a problem. And it's one of the things I thought about when I had the opportunity to be added to the slate, especially with the voting delegate. I was told, you know, only sign up for this if you're for sure that you're going to want to go. And the timing was interesting. It was right before the Texas primary in May when I had to make my final decision whether or not to try to go. And that was it was like the day after Rand Paul endorsed Romney on the Sean Hannity show, And it was also the day after the Ron Paul campaign essentially pulled the plug and said, well, we're not going to actively campaign and compete anymore. And it was very dispiriting because I thought, well, do I want to spend my own money? Because the party doesn't pay to get you to the national convention. You know, cost a couple thousand bucks. And do you want to, you know, spend that kind of money and time if you're going there and your own candidate isn't going to actively, you know, do anything other than maybe climb on board the Romney bandwagon? Now, I'm very glad I went because in the end, that isn't what happened. The Paul campaign it put on some great events, and they not only allowed us but encouraged us to cast a vote for Paul on the roll call ballot. And all of that, you know, in addition to meeting people that I admired, being able to fraternize with a lot of other Paul delegates and conservatives that I admired there at the convention. In the end, yes, there's the element of your kind of unwelcome guests. But on the other hand, I'd say there were thousands and thousands of delegates there. There were many people who you know, were respectful, and even if they weren't Paul people, you didn't feel like such a pariah as I was afraid that I might feel once I got there to Tampa.
All right, now what stands out to you in terms of your recollections? I know you kept notes of your time at the convention. As you look back on those, what's jumping off those pages?
Well, you know, the first thing is that it confirmed. I teach political science, and as a political scientist, I kind of suspected that the national convention would mirror what I know about the national leadership of the two big parties, where it's very, you know, top down, and to put it simply, the game is rigged. I knew that, you know, theoretically, but then being at the national convention, I could see that up close, and so there was a confirmation of that the convention process, it was tightly controlled. And the irony is, you know, Romney had an overwhelming number of delegates at that point committed to him, and all of the other candidates that had dropped out, other than Ron Paul, so the Gingrich and Santorum and so on, they had endorsed Romney. So there was no chance that Romney wasn't going to win, and yet his campaign was run by a bunch of control freaks who really were ungracious winners. And I think it did not serve Romney or his effort well in the long run, but in the short run, they were able to control the convention very tightly. So that was one thing that struck me. For example, there was no access to microphones on the convention floor. All of those were turned off. They were only turned on when the head honchos decided that they wanted to allow a particular person to talk, which wasn't very often. There was no debate over motions. There's no appeals of the ruling of the chair of the convention. You might think that a convention would run according to Robert's Rules of Order, but that isn't the case at the national conventions. It's all based on the House of Representatives rules, which is very centralized and top-down. And so once the chair of the convention makes a decision, you can't appeal. There's no debate. And that's, you could say that's undemocratic or that goes against, you know, our traditions of how meetings are run. That's all true. But that's the way it is. You couldn't bring signs into the convention hall. Everything was had to be pre-approved. That was spoken from the podium. Even Rand Paul, in giving his speech at the convention, could not mention Ron Paul. That was forbidden. And so he had to refer to a certain congressman from Texas in order to even make a reference to his own father. So it was very, very tightly controlled.
What is the story about this rules change? I couldn't keep track of all the technicalities, the technical aspects of how the convention runs and how the nominating process runs. I think the average person doesn't know a lot about it and isn't really inclined to learn. But there was some
right.
major rules change that took place, and there was a vote confirming this rule change. What was that all about?
Yes, there were several rules changes that were made by the Rules Committee of the convention in conjunction with the Republican National Committee, which is the group that really runs the national party. And the most all of them ended up being quite controversial. And it wasn't just Ron Paul people who were opposed. There were a lot of Tea Party people, a lot of traditional conservatives in the party, like Phyllis Schlafly and like Morton Blackwell from Virginia, that were long-time conservatives who realized that this was a power grab, trying to take power away from the grassroots, away from the state parties, and centralize it. And so one of the most controversial rules was voted on the very first day of the convention. The first day was on a Monday. That was canceled because there was a thought that the hurricane might be coming our way. It didn't end up coming, but on Tuesday, when we got things going, this was at the very beginning. There was no debate. John Boehner, who was Speaker of the House and was chair of the convention, he just brought it up for vote. And he said, vote aye or no on the Rules Committee report. Now, when the voting was done, it was by voice vote, and there was no way to tell if the ayes or the noes had it because it was evenly divided. And you can see this on YouTube, the clips that show it. It wasn't just the Iowa delegation. It was throughout the convention hall. It was an even vote. Now, normally what you'd have then is a division of the House where you'd have a standing vote or maybe go to a paper ballot to know exactly, you know, what the delegates want. But there was no interest in that. As soon as the vote was done, Boehner said, the ayes have it. He banged his gavel and he moved on. And those of us who were opposed, we booed, we yelled. It actually brought the convention to a halt for about 10 minutes. And the next person who was there to speak couldn't speak because the convention wouldn't come to order. But it was all to no avail in the end because the train moved on. Now, what upset people, especially the next day, was when a YouTube clip came out of somebody who had the presence of mind to turn around and take a video of the teleprompter that Boehner was reading from. And there we discovered that his actual words, the eyes have it, that was part of a script.
Wow.
So it wouldn't have made any difference how the convention delegates voted. We were just props in that particular charade.
Wow, that is right out of the Soviet Union. The eyes have it is written on the teleprompter.
Yes.
Man.
Yeah. Well, that's it. And one of the other Iowa delegates, Michelle, who is a lot younger than I, over breakfast when we were talking about this, she was almost in tears, and she said, you know, doesn't that just crush you? It's like, and then I said, well, you know, it probably should, but I said I'm cynical enough to not be surprised by it. It's brazen. But yet that's how power works. When you've got it, you're not willing to share it, and oftentimes you don't want to play fair. So, the sad thing is that the Democratic convention did the exact same thing a week later in Charlotte, and there's video clips of this too. You can find on YouTube where the mayor of Los Angeles was the chair, and there was a vote on changing the platform, adding God the platform, and also adding a reference to Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And those were controversial changes to the traditional wording of the Democrats' platform, so he put those up for a vote, and they needed two-thirds vote. And I don't even think they had a majority, but in the end, he pushed that through as well, and it was, again, it was a teleprompter that shows that the script was there. So it is kind of shocking, and yet that's the way it works.
Before I go on to ask you if you might extrapolate from your experience here to participation in the political process more generally, is there anything of burning significance that you want to share also from your own experiences there?
You know, a lot of it, being on the convention floor, one of the more pleasurable things for me as a delegate isn't the official business or who's talking up there, because they pull out a lot of, politicians and candidates to give these speeches. And frankly, I didn't care, to hear Chris Christie or all these different hacks that are talking to us. And so that I didn't really care so much about. But while you're there, you can mingle with thousands of other delegates on the floor, and you know, you catch notices of some of the famous people, whether they're media people or politicians or whatever, and most of them I wouldn't really care to speak to, but some of them I did. I saw Joe Scarborough, who's Chris MSNBC, used to be a congressman from Florida, so I talked to him briefly, and I knew that he had voted for Ron Paul in the Florida primary, and I asked him about that, and he said that he angsted about who he should vote for right up until the time he got to the voting booth on primary day. And then he said, as soon as he saw the ballot, he said it took him half a second to mark the ballot for Ron Paul. And I'm not always the greatest admirer of Scarborough, but I thought, well, you know, good for you. That's something. I also had a chance to talk to Jimmy Duncan, a congressman from Tennessee that I'm a great admirer of.
I think he's a good guy.
Yeah, Ron Paul supporter and great on foreign policy and on a lot of things. One of the things that it was kind of interesting was on the night that we had the roll call vote for president, Iowa was one of three states that gave a majority of our votes to Ron Paul during the roll call. And at the same time we voted for president in Iowa, our delegation chair, who was Drew Ivers, rather than the governor of Iowa, which would have been the more typical approach, Drew asked us to also vote for vice president. And he said it's unlikely that we're going to actually have a roll call for vice president, and we didn't. It was Paul Ryan was chosen by acclamation. But I thought it was interesting that the Iowa delegation, I was able to see the vote totals after the fact, and a plurality of the delegation actually did not vote for Ryan. There were votes for a variety of other folks, from Rand Paul to Ron Paul to one of my favorite candidates, Tom Woods, even got two votes.
I heard about that. I wasn't supposed to, I think, but I did hear that I got a couple of votes there. All right.
Now, you know, it's unofficial because at the end, you know, they didn't we didn't actually get to cast them, but that's the way it would have turned out.
Now, in talking to other delegates after all was said and done, did you get the impression that some of them had been so soured by the experience that they were giving up politics, or did they think that, well, now I've just got to be smarter, I've got to work harder, I've got to fight against the corrupt establishment? Which way did they go?
I would say that a little of both. A lot of the Iowa delegates, which are the ones that I've stayed in touch with, we call ourselves Liberty delegates. A lot of us have stayed active within the Republican Party in Iowa, and for a time, it was about a 2-year period. We actually dominated the state Republican Party. We lost that this past summer, as you know, the tide kind of went out, and that's part of the problem, I guess. With the Ron Paul campaign, there were some problems in terms of I hate to use the word marketing of the candidate, but in politics, that's really kind of what it is. There were some problems with the Paul campaign at the top level.
No, I refuse to believe that.
I know it's it's hard to believe, but there were a few problems there. But then there were also some problems at the ground level in terms of the support. For one thing, many of the Paul supporters were young, which is a great thing. And it bodes well for the future, right? That the young generation was energized by Paul's message, and ironically, he was the oldest candidate, but he had the youngest base of support. But the problem is that young people not only do they vote the least, and in this case, you know, many of them did turn out to vote for Paul, but because they don't have the experience, they're not necessarily as politically savvy, and they may not see the value of staying in for the long run. And the other thing is that many of them, being libertarian and oftentimes identifying, say, with anarcho-capitalism, have the anarchist streak where they really don't believe in electoral politics. Maybe they don't believe in the necessity of government, and so then you're bringing your base, trying to plug them into a political campaign in order to achieve power in government. There's kind of a contradiction or an ambivalence there. So a lot of people who hadn't been involved in campaigns before felt like, well, we lost because the whole the whole system was rigged. Every time Ron Paul lost, it must have been vote fraud. And I don't think that was nearly as widespread as some people suspected, but it kind of gave them an excuse in the end to say, well, forget this. You know, the Republicans are a hopeless cause. We're not going to be involved in this, you know, anymore. So I think that's unfortunate because in the end, we have a two-party system, and as important as third parties can be, in Washington, they really don't even register. So you've got to pick your poison, in a sense, between those two, and see it as a tool. That's really all it is. It's a tool to advance your principles. And so, you know, unfortunately, I do think a lot of the Paul supporters after 2012 have kind of checked out as a result of that campaign.
Do you think there's anything that you learned or observed, or even anything that you know as a political scientist that might be useful or relevant when we look at a 2016 Rand Paul campaign?
Well, I think, you know, the interesting thing about Rand Paul being, you know, the son and protege in many ways of his father is that he's almost the... I don't know what you'd say. Mirror image isn't necessarily the right thing. Maybe it's almost a photographic image where if you go back to the old days when we used film and you had negatives, it's almost like that, where the parts of Ron Paul, where he was strong, oftentimes Rand Paul, I think, is weak. And where Ron was weak, I think Rand is strong. So it's in many ways, it's an interesting balancing act that Rand Paul is trying to achieve, where he's trying to keep his father's base of support of libertarians and constitutionalists, but he's trying to branch out into the wider Tea Party movement, the religious right, mainstream Republicans, and I'm not sure in the end if he's going to be able to maintain that and not give away too much credibility, because if you stretch yourself too much, you know, you become open to the John Kerry flip-flopping kind of accusation, and I think there's some truth to that right now with Rand Paul, where he's trying to situate himself within the party to have as wide appeal as possible. So, you know, Ron Paul was known as a truth teller. He was known as uncompromising. He was pure. Rand Paul, much more of a compromiser, much more of a nuanced approach. He's a much better politician, I think, than his father, at least at the national stage. But the downside to being a better politician is that I think he's also not as honest. When he gets the attention, he gets the spotlight, sometimes, especially in foreign policy, rather than using that as a way to tell the truth about things, I think he sometimes fudges or sometimes dodges or sometimes just doesn't say things the way they really are. And so I don't know. You know, I have some ambivalence about Senator Paul.
Well, I'll say a little something here. I generally don't comment on this just out of friendship to a certain senator's father. But, you know, I've been accused of hating Rand, and I've been accused of being a Rand cheerleader. So I don't know what... and it's from the same sentence. Like, so I don't understand what the problem is. I've basically said... I understand what Rand is doing. I see what he's trying to do. I've been assured by people that he is as sound on issues as you or I are.
Yep.
I've been assured of that by people who would be in a position to know. So I do understand what he's doing. One of my points would be, though, that you can actually explain the foreign policy position in a way that will resonate with the base. You can do it. I mean, the neocons' foreign policy is blowing up in their faces everywhere they turn. All Rand has to do is pull that dagger out and stick it in and keep sticking it in over and over and over until they're going to be a squirming pile of flesh on the ground. All he's got to do is just stick it in. It doesn't matter. It doesn't even have to be precise. He doesn't have to be a surgeon about it. Just stick the dagger. Okay, now, let me say a few other things here, though. When I think back to what excited me about the Ron Paul campaigns, I mean, when I think about what did we like about Ron Paul? That he took one position and stuck with it. that he told the truth constantly, that he never used slippery language or said he was being misinterpreted or whatever. No, this is my position. I don't care that it's controversial. I'm taking it and I'm standing with it. And we loved that about him. And yes, I'm saying things that are totally, totally at odds with the base, but they've got to be said about the Fed and about foreign policy. We loved that about him. And I don't remember at that time, I don't remember one person saying, you know, from the Ron Paul Revolution group, I don't remember anybody saying, you know, it's great for Ron to be principled and everything, but we'd get so much farther if he would just shut up sometimes or just distort things or just try and dance around issues. I don't remember anybody saying that. Whereas today, I get that constantly. Today, I'm saying, oh, hey, look, man, you got to live in the real world. I didn't get any of these implicit insults of Ron, which is what every one of those statements is. Every one of those statements is an implicit insult to Ron. I didn't hear any of those at that time.
Right.
And then also what I guarantee you a Rand Paul campaign will be run by money-grubbing creeps. Absolute. Prove me wrong, Rand. Prove me wrong. But I guarantee you it'll be Jesse Benton and the whole usual crew of people who are going to get their five-figure monthly salaries. I guarantee you it will be that. I don't want it to be. I would love to be proven wrong, and I'm waiting to be proven wrong. And I acknowledge perfectly well that Rand probably has the best voting record of any senator in U.S. history. I absolutely freely acknowledge that. But that doesn't mean I'm not allowed to have these other concerns.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I agree with you totally. And you know, Jesse Benton specifically, but maybe others at the national Ron Paul campaign leadership, I mean, to me, that was one of the weaknesses. If you're going to run a national campaign for president, you need to bring somebody on board who's had experience at that level, like successful experience at that level. I think he was, you don't necessarily think of your grandson-in-law as your first choice for that kind of position. Even if he has a stellar personal character, I think it's not a wise decision. So I think you're exactly right. And I think, you know the irony is that Rand Paul has been blessed with a type of eloquence and a speaking style and a way to answer, you know, hostile questions by the media, you know, in a way that I think exceeds that of his father. And so he in some ways is a better messenger of the message, but it's almost as though he's willing to throw the message overboard in order to speak these neocon
just when the message is gaining steam. You know, I mean, it would be like somebody switching to support the Iraq war in 2007. Like, what?
Right.
Nobody supports the Iraq war anymore in 2007. Like, why would you choose then? Well, likewise, on foreign policy, there is a chunk of the GOP electorate that is angry and alienated with regard to foreign policy. Nobody's going after that chunk. And I think there is a half-hearted Rand effort to go after it, but it should be full-blown. And if he's uncomfortable with some of the arguments his father made on behalf of that foreign policy, he doesn't have to make those arguments.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And also, if Rand were to be nominated as a Republican candidate, and he goes up against a Hillary Clinton or someone like that, he would have an opportunity, if he's got a consistent, clear record, to take votes away and appeal to Democrats, progressives, who don't want to be so hawkish and don't want to maintain some kind of a global empire or try to maintain it. So, you know, you're also ceding a lot of high ground there, I think, not just within the party, but among independents and among Democrats who don't think that we should police the whole world. And so I agree. I think it's a missed opportunity. The more he tries to play along with what he thinks Republicans want to hear, I'm not even sure that he's correct in that. It's a handful of party pros and financiers that take that line. But the rank and file, I don't think they're on board that neocon foreign policy.
And you know what I think would also get Rand some votes and support, and I'd like to see him do it. The National Journal ran an article not very long ago about Rand's outreach to Jewish and Israeli interests, and they quoted somebody as saying, you know, we we're increasingly sympathetic to Rand. We appreciate his outreach. Now, we all know Ron Paul's an anti-Semite, and that's just right there in the article. Now, what I want to hear, what I want to hear from Rand, and what I think anybody who believes in filial piety wants to hear from Rand is, hey, look, that's my father. And I might not agree with him on everything, but how dare you insult him that way? And if I have to, if being elected president means I have to throw my father under the bus, then I guess I won't be president. Now, that would get him support even from people who don't like his father, but who like the idea of fathers and who like the idea of loyal sons. Why am I not hearing words like this in defense of his father? It would be in his own political interest. It's not even like he'd be shooting himself in the foot. Who's going to say, who is going to say, oh, he defended his father. Can't vote for him.
Right. No, I agree. You're exactly right there. So I'm hoping that maybe Senator Paul or someone close to him will rethink some of this. It's still, you know, relatively early, and the memories of the American voters are pretty notoriously short.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you don't say.
He's got some time to reposition and repackage before 2016. But I think staying on the present road. I don't know. I think he's, you know, being, they're trying to be a little bit too clever in the way they're doing this, and they may end up kind of like the Aesop's fable of the dog who's got a bone in his mouth and sees one in the stream and wants two instead of one and ends up with nothing. I think, you know, he's got to be a little bit careful about that.
All right, Jeff, it's been great talking to you again. This is all very interesting and compelling stuff. We'll have you on again sometime in the future. I'm going to keep an eye on your writing, and we'll get you on to talk about some of these themes again. But it was great getting your personal recollections from this turbulent and important time. Thanks again.
Well, thank you, Tom. It was a pleasure to speak with you again.
Okay, everybody, help us out here at the show. Help me pay the bills here. Keep things going by becoming a supporting listener at supportinglisteners.com. Get transcripts of all the interviews. You get discounts at the Mises store and a bunch of other Liberty places that you're inclined to buy from. 60% off at mylibertyclassroom.com, plus many goodies to come. My new book is finished. I'm going with Real Dissent as the title, and the subtitle, A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. You guys are going to like this, I think. If you like this show and you don't like the book, then I don't understand how the world works. But you guys who are helping out the show will get that Kindle book as one of your goodies. I will have a print edition of the book as almost an afterthought. I'm intending it primarily as an e-book because it's got some hyperlinks in it. The print edition obviously won't have those. So that's going to be one of the goodies. I just talked to my web guy. By the end of the month, we'll have my Ron Paul homeschool courses that I've finished, the two of them that I've finished up and running, to be purchased outside the Ron Paul curriculum. You can purchase them as part of the Ron Paul program at ronpaulhomeschool.com. But I'm going to have my own site where if you just want my courses and you don't want to sign up for the whole Ron Paul program, you can get them just from me. And that should be done by the end of the month. And these are going to be goodies that I'm also going to be offering to those of you who are at the higher levels of support. These are courses that as an adult you would not feel that your intelligence was being insulted. These are courses that any adult would profit from, I think. 180 lessons on Western civilization from antiquity to 1492. I think anybody could stand to know more about that stuff. You'd be much more confident in yourself knowing all these, knowing who Aristotle was. Why was he important? What did he think? You know, who are these people? You hear all these names. Thomas Aquinas. Yeah, I know he was some guy, but I don't know much else. All that sort of stuff is covered to the point where you will feel very, very confident. And of course, any children going through the program, my goodness, well, children, teenagers, I suppose, are going to have a leg up. That's all I can say. I don't know of any school anywhere that in high school gives you 2 years of Western Civ, a full year of Western Civ 1, a full year of Western Civ 2, plus my government course, 90 lessons on all kinds of subjects related to government, government policy, related to theories of government, related to types of government, related to natural rights and all the different theories of natural rights. All that's going to be available very soon, and those of you supporting the show at the higher levels of support will also get that as a goodie. I am determined to give you value at least as much as what you're giving me in support of the show. All right, Ron Paul next week, probably on Thursday. but we'll have to wait and see just to be sure. So make sure and stick around for these episodes. Make sure and see me at the end of next week, August 15th, in Nashville, Tennessee. Get details on that at nightofclarity.com. Thanks, everybody. See you next week.
The Tom Woods Show.